Spanking a baby's bottom, which soon will be true, James. Because you know, so
well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I'm not planning to spank a baby anytime. I'm gonna have to tell it off for.
Okay, so you're not planning it, but it might happen, is what you're saying.
Well, maybe if we give birth to the boss baby
or professional baby,
and then I'll have to get rid of its capitalist tendencies.
Your baby will be a rad lib.
Yeah, that's a horrifying thought. I don't really want to get into that. So hello, welcome to the Anime Podcast, the only anarchist podcast, or the only leftist podcast that does not feature anyone that went to Oxford or Cambridge on a daily basis. So today we're talking about the Tamil Tigers. This is season 3, where we're focused completely on melted groups, terrorists, rebel groups, anyone that's armed, and what we can learn from them as revolutionaries, the good and the bad. So today, as I said, we're doing the Tamil Tigers, who we will discuss and see how we feel about them at the beginning and the end. I think for most of us, it would be fairly neutral, much in the same way that we discussed Hamas in the first episode that we did. So we're also joined by our guest, Nikita, who hosts the, what's it called again?
Oh,
the
Leftover
Podcast. So yeah, how are you guys getting on at the moment?
Good. How about you?
Yeah, I'm very hungover today, so.
I'm hoping to get there.
And Alex on the boat, how are you at the moment?
I'm fine. I should just bring up that you said instead of militant groups, you said melted groups, which is also true at the same time, because most militant groups are melts. So that works in a certain way. Otherwise, I'm good. The boat is still afloat, which is always good when you live on a boat.
It's the basic thing that you want from a boat, really, is it staying up?
It's functional.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, very rarely do I get attacked by pirates, so that's always nice too.
Do you use them for any suicide attacks like the Tamil Tigers did?
I think you'll find that pirates were anarcho-capitalists, so they wouldn't really be engaging in suicide attacks. They would have felt that they were destroying a commodity in themselves.
Are you saying pirates were anarcho-capitalists?
No, I'm saying they were anarcho-capitalists. That's why they wouldn't do suicide attacks, because they'd be destroying themselves. And they see themselves as a commodity.
I think saying they were anarcho-capitalists is a bit of a reach. I'm just going to throw that out there.
For the 17th century, I think it's applicable. I don't think now it's applicable. I think if you were back then, you were going, oh, let's talk about this. Let's, you know, there's very few ideological figures thrown around the term anarchy. Well, some, but not in the modern sense of anarchy. So I think for the beginning of a fucking podcast about the Tamil Tigers, just can we move on?
Well, I think we found our theme for season 4, maybe, is... retroactively.
I'd love to do a podcast series on pirates. That'd be fucking great.
Yeah. So let's move on then to the meat of the podcast, talking about the Tamil Tigers. So does anyone want to give a brief overview of how they came about, the situation in Sri Lanka after the British left up till about the 80s?
So I guess you have to sort of talk about the British themselves as well. So, sorry, I'm going to say I'm a lot, because that's what I do. But the British, while they had full control of Sri Lanka from sort of like 1815 onwards, had sort of stripped the peasants of their land and then went on to import Tamil and South Indian workers from India into Sri Lanka. But then sort of over the course of the British in Sri Lanka, there were like missionary sort of schools set up in largely Tamil areas. And the missionary schools taught English, and English was the official language. So the Tamil population, not all of them, but they did sort of end up in sort of good government roles under British leadership. And then Sri Lanka sort of becomes independent, and the Sinhalese majority are like, okay, hold on, what the hell is this? And they're before they sort of really attack the community in like the Tamil community in Sri Lanka, there's like a thing they do, like a citizenship act, which basically makes these Tamil workers and South Indian workers who came from India stateless, which is just sort of like one bit of this very like just this sort of decolonization that is very messy, and the sort of like ethnic issues that had already existed in Sri Lanka get worse and worse, because there's no such thing really as peaceful decolonization when the British are involved. And you know, this is all sort of ongoing from back in those days as well. And then there's the Sinhala Only Act in 1956, which is sort of like this like very like linguistic nationalism, and it makes Sinhalese the official language of Sri Lanka, which I think was still called Ceylon at the time. And it fucks over the Tamil population. And then there are just more and more things that the Sinhalese led government do to sort of harm and disenfranchise the Tamil population. But I think you can probably help me out with this, because I've definitely missed a lot.
That was a good overview of the first part there. I listened to a couple of BBC audio documentaries in preparation for this, and they completely and utterly failed to discuss British imperialism and its effect in Sri Lanka, and how it basically seeds the sows for what becomes the situation that creates the Tamil Tigers, which really tells you all you need to know about the BBC and the way that they see the world and how what they should be talking about. Alex, have you got anything to add there?
Yeah, basically a bit about how it's what was done in Ceylon, as it was known, as the British called it, was, you know, it's textbook British Empire, it was textbook European empires. I mean, very similar situation happened in Rwanda and Central Africa. Same thing happened, well, not same thing, you know, horrific genocide in the 90s, but you have a similar kind of a situation in Burundi nearby, where you have the Hutu and the Tutsi. Again, the Hutu are the majority. They feel like they're being disadvantaged, and then they commit horrendous pogroms and the horrendous violence. It's traditional imperial tactics, divide and conquer. There's one question I wanted to ask, though, because I wasn't able to figure it out from anything I read or watched. Were the Tamils a pre-existing group in what's now Sri Lanka, or were they increased in number by basically importing workers from the southeast? But did they exist before the British were there?
So are you asking whether there was a Tamil population within the country beforehand, or were they completely imported by the British?
Yeah, that's my question. I don't know.
Yeah, as far as I know, and I might be wrong, but that is my understanding, is that they were completely moved there by the British to be a sort of middle-class workforce. Because obviously, you know, the British Raj is around at the time, and there is the Tamils for the British Empire were quite applicable to them, and so.
Well, there were Hindus in Sri Lanka before the Dutch came. I know that, but I don't know if the Tamil people are specifically like the Hindu group in Sri Lanka. Like, I don't really understand. I don't know that bit.
Because obviously, it plays a big role in how things are perceived. I mean, if they were there before, either way, you can always rewrite history and say, oh, they were an invading force or they were brought in as part of the empire, because that's what the Hutus did to the Tutsi in Rwanda. They said, oh, you invaded, but of course they didn't. They'd been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But even if it was, of course, doesn't really make a difference, because you can always rewrite the history. And what the British did is textbook. So, I mean, you don't really see the same thing in Ireland. You do definitely see, kind of when independence is gained, you definitely see an attempt to try and bring back the language, which didn't work, or by putting forward kind of Catholics in positions of civil service, etc. But it's never really the same type of situation there. So I think what's interesting about that, though, is that Ceylon was actually considered, when the British left in 1948, a kind of a perfect colony. The economy was really, really good. The level of literacy was enormous. It was, English was spoken by a mostly pliant kind of Tamil civil service. So, I mean, what really followed, again, the documentary I watched was by the BBC. They seemed to be kind of completely shocked that this would happen, but it just fits that pattern completely of European colonization and the sad after effects.
Yeah, so that my family are East African Indians. They, we were definitely like settler colonials who got yeeted out. But yeah, it's just one of those, like, decolonization it's just messy. Like, it doesn't happen peacefully or neatly.
Yeah, completely. It's also just like a situation that continues into the 2000s as well, where, you know, in the 90s, there are Sinhalese terrorist groups effectively taking out attacks on the government because, you know, they're not, as far as they're concerned, they're not doing enough for the Sinhalese people. So it is definitely like a post-colonial country that really suffers from these scars that the British Empire pretty much left on it. To get into that a little bit more, then, you basically have attacks on Tamil people, quite brittle as well. And that really is what creates the Tamil Tigers. They decide to cobble together and, physically defend themselves in which way is possible. So does anyone want to pick up that thread a little bit?
There's a couple of things going on there, because it's not merely just the various Tamil groups, because the Tigers, or the LTT, LTTE, which Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. There you go. Hey, I said it. But they're just one of the groups originally. There's many others. But there's another group called, I think it was called the JVP, which was around at the same time, but in another part of Sri Lanka. And it seems like there's a lot of things going on there, because both were kind of, you know, made up of mostly young, fairly well-educated, because Sri Lanka had one of the only, I think it's one of the few countries in the world that cover education from birth till university. So you have a very highly educated population. By the 60s, you have increasing unemployment. You, oddly enough, the Sinhalese government at the time, who were kind of leaning towards Cuba and leaning towards Russia at the time. And so I think it's around the 1972, they renamed themselves the Democratic Socialist, I think it's Republic or Democratic Socialist Republic of Sri Lanka or something along those lines, are trying to nationalize these the tea industries and trying to kind of have an essential economy in the 60s. But it leads to a lot of unemployment. And as we all know, because we seem to be, you know, living through this now, that leads to radicalization in kind of identity terms. And so instead of kind of uniting as a working class, these type of identity-based tectonic plates start erupting. And so the focus on the Tamils as this kind of people who are taking the jobs that should belong to young Sinhalese men in the civil service, or how they're for years they were the puppets of the British Empire, all of that comes into it. And the pogroms began in the 50s and even before, really, the economic changes in the 60s, but they go on until 1983. And so this, as James said, it's a process. Lots of different things are going on, but ultimately, if you're going to focus on anything, it's the kind of early 80s end up being the kind of the catalyst for it. So it's kind of, there's a pre-war stage, pre-civil war stage, which is pogroms, increasing oppression of the Tamils, and all the while having a very educated population too, who know what's going on to them, you know. So it's unique in many ways, is Sri Lanka. I don't think I've ever come across a country that had that many different things going on at the same time.
Yeah, you think you're reading about one pogrom and it turns out you're reading about another one, because like three happened in the same decade. Yeah, like this area at this point in like the late 70s, early 80s, so the Tamil Tigers are established in 76. Then in 77, there's an anti-Tamil pogrom, which a lot of like leftists are caught up in as well, or people who are sympathetic to a particular leftist politician, which it amounted to 9,000 families being displaced. And then 1981, you've got the burning of Jaffna Library, which is like a community library that was set up in the 30s, and it's just a site of, or was a site of like hugely meaningful historical artifacts and manuscripts for Tamil people. The big sort of pogrom that basically kicked off the civil war was in 1983, and which started off with the Tigers ambushing the army in Jaffna, which is like at the north of Sri Lanka, and it's like a Tamil area. And then in retaliation, there's a pogrom, an anti-Tamil pogrom that results in death of about 3,000 Tamils. And this is all across Sri Lanka. And that leads more of the youth towards the Tamil Tigers as well, who are watching this happen. And, you know, there's a presidential commission that says, you know, restitution needs to be paid. But to this day, none has. And there have been no legal proceedings against people who committed the pogrom either.
Just very, very briefly, it should also be said that India is not standing by.
Oh, no.
And it should be said that they have a lot of reasons to want to interfere. That there are Tamils, of course, on the subcontinent who are very close by, who are very sympathetic, in the same way that the Pashtuns in Pakistan are very sympathetic to the Pashtuns in Algeria, in the same way that Irish Catholics were very sympathetic to the Irish Catholics in Northern Ireland, et cetera, et cetera. Imperial border set by the British. We all know the story. But it's very important to know that it's kind of unclear exactly when they start doing it, but they do start allowing groups like the LTTE and others train in, you know, pretty openly in the southeast, in the Tamil, I think it's called Tamil Nuada or something along those lines.
Oh, Tamil Nadu?
Yeah, that's it, Nadu. So they're training them there, they're letting them train there, they're actually training them there, they're giving them weapons, and they are basically looking the other way. And I think that's late 70s, early 80s as well. So they don't want the Tamils in their territory to seek independence. So I think they want to kind of covertly support what's going on in northern and eastern Sri Lanka, and that'll come back as we'll talk about later on when the Indians actually openly intervene.
Yeah, so this is the Indian intelligence agency who were doing this, definitely under Indira Gandhi in like the early to mid 1980s.
Just as a side note as well, the files from the British SES MI6 about this time as well has been completely destroyed, apparently by a mistake, but clearly on purpose, and more than likely that on the other side the British were advising the Sinhalese government about what to do in this situation. So you can always, that'll give you an idea of like the way that it's going to play out in the future. If you've already got at the very beginning of it, the British government pretty much planning to intervene in some way or another. So, you've talked about the first attack there. Things start heating up. It's, you know, it moves into a civil war fairly coherently and quickly. And the Tamil Tigers are partly famous for one of the first forces at the time to sort of use an effective suicide attack, which comes in the form of the Black Tigers, who are a specific division of the Tamil Tigers that are all volunteers that decide to do suicide attacks and work quite effectively, because at the time the Tamil Tigers don't have artillery or planes or anything like that that can really create a dent and the fortifications of a conventional army. So for, you know, there's one time where they basically load up a truck filled with petrol and, you know, drive it right into a base where it explodes. And then a conventional force comes afterwards and then helps clear the base. So what do we think of these use of suicide attacks? Because this is we talked about it in the Hamas episode, and as far as I know, this will be the last time that we'll really be talking about suicide attacks in any great detail, as a psychological tactic, but also an actual tactic in war.
I mean, there are two most famous figures who were killed. They're by all means not the most famous. Our Ranjiv Gandhi, who was by then I think the former Prime Minister of India,
yep,
who had been part of the intervention which we'll may or may not talk about, in the late 80s, when the about 100,000 Indian soldiers are airdropped into, I believe, northern Sri Lanka, northern eastern, to kind of keep the Sinhalese army out. And the that actually resulted in a mini war between the LTTE, the Tigers, and the Indian army. And so they didn't particularly like him very much after that and took him out after as a result. But they also, far more importantly, assassinated via suicide bomber the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka, Premadesa, I think his name is. Pardon me for anyone listening who may be Sri Lankan. I sometimes get names wrong, but I believe it was Premadesa in the early 90s. But there are others. There's, I think, 37 members of parliament. There's multiple members, kind of high ranking members of the army. Basically, you know, it is a very effective, terrifying tactic in a country which has no history of it. In the same way that it was very, very effective in the 80s, the mid 80s, when the Hezbollah, or some version of it, whatever, maybe it was pre-Hezbollah, you know, blew up an American Marine base in Beirut in 1985, and the Americans were gone within a couple of months. These things can be very effective. They're obviously purely from a military perspective, that type of asymmetrical warfare can be effective. I don't necessarily think, and you know, it's going to be something we're going to talk about, it's something that gains you a lot of supporters. And it's, you know, maybe we should kind of somewhat question whether, you know, how representative the Tamil Tigers were of their community in doing that. You know, the Tamils had about, in total, maybe 5,000 to 10,000, that's the figures I've heard, members, you know, at a given time, probably more over the 25 years they're in operation. But I don't think it, you know, from other than a purely military perspective, I don't know if it's gaining a lot of people, you know, support for them. It's very easy to cast them as terrorists and as quote unquote savages when they do things like that, much like Hamas.
But, you know, I guess the difference in terms of what they're doing with, say, Hamas is it is attacking politicians and police and people like that. As far as I know of, there isn't any suicide bombings in, like, you know, churches or...
There are bombings, not suicide bombings or things, but there are bombings of banks, and there's targeting of civilians, including Tamils themselves, who were seen as collaborators. So, again, much like the IRA would do in the north, in Northern Ireland, in the 1980s and 90s.
It's about, you know, having demands, and until... I can't remember. I think it was in the 2000s when they actually dropped the demand for their own state. I think probably, I'm not sure if this was post 9/11 or not, but yeah, it was about, you know, because this civil war went on for a really, really long time. It's about just, you know, exhausting your enemy, and these are our demands, you know, acquiesce to them or we will keep doing this.
Yeah, it was in 2002 was when they dropped that demand, which created a ceasefire effectively, which is actually the time where most of the information of the Tamil Tigers come out, because anything between them, the government doesn't effectively doesn't let any Western journalists go into the Tamil controlled occupations. And the only person that I know of that did, Mary Colvin, ended up losing her eye, who's, you know, probably was the greatest war journalist of all time. So if you ever wondered where she got the eye patch from, though, it is in Sri Lanka. I can't remember which side it was off the top of my head, but I'm sure, you know, she said she was a journalist and it was the government forces that hit her. I might be wrong in that, but
they definitely, like, there was one massacre of like a French NGO where they killed like 17 people, and that was the government doing it.
Yeah, so information on the Tamil Tigers can be difficult to come by for different reasons, but yeah, it's this ceasefire is really where we get a chunk of information. Alex, have you got anything?
So there's something I want to bring up there, which is, I kind of questioned it during my little spiel there before, but I do think it should be said again, because I don't know the answer mostly, which is how much support did the Tigers have from the Tamil population? Because the Tamil population, depending on what statistics you kind of use, are less, certainly less than 20%. Some statistics are saying like 11% of the population. of a population of about 20 million. The Tamil Targas themselves are about 5,000 to 10,000 at a given time. Again, and you'll hear different things about from different people about the tactics they use, whether quote unquote using people as shields in the last days of the campaign in 2008-2009, or whether it be just in general the kind of killing of quote unquote collaborators. Again, this is the language used at the time, or the use of child soldiers, having their volunteers wear cyanide around their necks so that they would never surrender. They take the cyanide instead. Like, I don't know the answer as to how supportive the Tamils were of the LTTE. And I think if we're going to have an opinion on them as a revolutionary group, whether right or wrong, we should probably ask that obvious question. Did they have support?
There was definitely support in the diaspora, but diaspora politics are different, aren't they? There are a lot of different revolutionary groups who maybe aren't so popular in their homelands, but the people who've, particularly the Tamil population in Europe and America, a lot of them have been displaced by war, so they will be coming at it from a different perspective, I guess.
Yeah, we worked in a restaurant in Toronto, and all the cooks were Tamil, and I didn't bring it up because you didn't want, they weren't in Toronto for. Because they wanted to be reminded of the events in Sri Lanka. But I do, and a lot of support, financial support, obviously came from the diaspora, much like the IRA was supported very heavily by the Irish diaspora. But actually in northern and eastern Sri Lanka, do we know? Is there any way to know? Because as James said, not a lot of information is coming out. But were they? They must have been supported by somebody, because the population were, for the most part, listening to their edicts, because they were in control for at least 20 years.
Yeah, I guess it's a question that we don't have the answer to.
Yeah.
Basically. Because has anyone ever... I don't think any polling was really done on the...
Well, should we send Ipsos Mori down there?
Yeah, exactly.
I can tell you that the IRA, while it existed in the North, but most people didn't vote for Sinn Féin until after 2003. I can tell you that because I can point to elections and I can point to whatever. Whereas I know there was a separate political party that I think was part of a broad coalition with groups. I think it was the Tamil National Union or something along those lines. But they were a political party which weren't, its armed wing wasn't the LTTE,
Yeah. Well, talking of which, though, as we're discussing that, and maybe we can sort of try and thread the needle a little bit, they were a group, and might be the only group, that we're going to be talking about this season that used child soldiers as well. And again, it's another thing that is very difficult to quite get information on to any great degree. But obviously, the use of child soldiers is wrong. First of all,
objectively,
abhorrent is the word.
Yeah, and it kind of tells you a lot about the military that is using them a lot of the time. So, what do we think about the Tamil Tigers' use of child soldiers?
It's definitely worth just to contextualize. A lot of the paramilitary groups that were backed by the government also used child soldiers. So it was just a practice that was used in the war, and this isn't excusing anything, just contextualizing. And also basically the tsunami in 2004, towards the end of the war, left a hell of a lot of orphans, and that kind of created this healthy supply of child soldiers towards the end as well, even though the Tamil Tigers had been promising that they'd stop doing it. They didn't.
Again, the figures could be slightly off because you can get different figures from different people. But when they finally surrendered, when the civil war ended in May of 2009, there was about 560 child soldiers that were taken alive as opposed to dead, out of about, I think it was about 11,000 who were taken, mix of Tamil, Tigers and other groups and civilians. So, I mean, it wasn't a very large chunk of their forces. So you have to come somewhat, and again, if that's representative of the type of numbers they've always had, you'd have to somewhat scratch your head and say, was it worth doing such an abhorrent thing? Because you're not going to get much support. I mean, I think it's one thing as the Tigers did, recruit men and women of ages above 18. You're going to, you know, there might be some conservative weirdos who'd be like, oh, women shouldn't be fighting. But, it's universally recognized to be disgusting to grab children and do this to them. I mean, it's child abuse. It's the worst, it's horrific. And again, you're not like any evidence I've ever heard is that, no offense, but kids aren't the best soldiers. It's for lots of reasons. So it's not even that you're gaining that much by doing it and you're losing so much by doing it. So I do think it says something. And again, I'd have to read an entire book about the Tigers to figure this out. But I mean, the leader of the group who we haven't talked about yet, who I always have a problem pronouncing his name, and that's my problem, but I will try. Prabhakaran. Is that how you pronounce it?
Probably.
Yes. Now, he seemed to have kind of a culty vibe going on, and I wouldn't be particularly surprised if people didn't question him. He seemed to be say what you will about him. He lived and died by the sword, as we'll get to. But it seemed that his word was law, and so if he, in one moment said this, hey, we're going to do this because we need the troops, even if they're child soldiers. That says something about them as well. It says that they kind of fell into that trap that a lot of militant groups do once they become, so entrenched in these types of war, which is by any means necessary. And I think it's sadly you destroy any credibility or any ability to gain wider support beyond your base by doing things like that. So I don't think it works on any level.
Yes, because they're, I think, they're kind of, the wider story is quite sympathetic. And then you get to this, and then you get to the torture and stuff, and it does change it.
Yeah, for sure. That's all quite succinct and interesting, what you guys are saying there. I think it also reveals a couple of other things. First of all, Alex saying no offense. To children. One, we don't have that many child listeners as far as I know. And I don't know if it is offensive to say that children are not good soldiers.
Well, you never know. I don't want to be cancelled.
You want to get cancelled by the child soldier
identity. It's a really powerful lobby.
And then the true believers as well.
Yeah. But also, like, if you want to see how popular the Tamil Tigers are, especially Prabhakaran, the amount of videos that get produced now, by people in Sri Lanka and, the UK and America, like, he definitely has a real cult of personality. To some extent, even now there's chunks of people that still really idolize them. And you don't get that from absolutely nothing, that level of idolization. So
I will just say this, James, martyrdom is a very powerful artistic and ideological force.
So while we're talking about that, though, the Tamil Tigers effectively had ideological underpinning that wasn't just to create the Elam state. They also claimed to be socialists. So I have absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever, apart from what it says in the Wikipedia. I couldn't find anything else to back that up with. But they did, effectively create a state within a state. They had a law system that was based on the British law system, apparently. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but there you go. And they claimed that it was in UN charters, even though they had the death penalty. I don't know if that contradicts each other, but, so they did have a police force that wasn't linked to the army, and anyone serving in the army wasn't allowed to be in the police force. But again, the judges for the courts, the only way that you could be a judge would be by serving in the military, which doesn't really sound like socialism to me. So Alex, what are your thoughts on, and if you want to explain some of their ideology?
Yeah, I mean, Sri Lanka's I don't know a huge amount about this other than the research I did for the podcast. But it seems a very left-wing country anyway. I mean, you have the attempts by I think it's Banjarnaica. I think, again, apologies for people who know the correct pronunciation, in the 60s, who was attempting to kind of move towards a Cuba in USSR. You have an insurrection in the 70s by a group called the JVP, which is mostly unemployed young university graduates. There's another attempt at that in, I think, the late 80s, early 90s, in which maybe as many as 40 or 50,000 young men are basically either killed outright in fighting in insurrection or taken, tortured and murdered by the Sri Lankan state. And that's separate from the Tamils. You know, you have a country which renames itself in 1972, the Democratic Socialist Republic of Sri Lanka. You have a very highly educated population. So I think it's an interesting thing to bring it up. So whether the Tamils were actually, you know, socialist in quotation marks, or whether this was merely a sign of the fact that the culture was highly educated, left-leaning, and they felt the need to say that, I don't know. I could definitely say that the JVP were out-and-out Marxists. You know, they wanted to form a unitary, communist, quote, in quotation marks, state in Sri Lanka. And it's much more, it's much easier to point to them and say, well, you know, they tick all the boxes for, you know, groups that existed like the Red Brigades or the they were much more effective than the Bader Meinhof, but anyway, by the Red Brigades and by groups like that. Whereas the Tamils, it seems that it's an ethno-nationalist movement, which, you know, from an Irish perspective, it makes it's similar in the way that the IRA would call itself socialist, but in fact didn't really do anything. And certainly Sinn Féin, its modern iteration, doesn't particularly espouse socialist ideas now. So whether it was just merely something you said because Sri Lanka has a left-leaning kind of culture politically, I think is a question which I don't know the answer for, but I would lean towards that.
Yeah, I guess you could probably like extrapolate from who their allies were. Like they had connections with like the PKK and the Maoist Naxalite movement, who just sees like Maoists who've been at war for 50 years with the Indian government within India. And also, I guess a big one is North Korea have been, from 1997, were their like largest procurer of weapons. So you probably, but then also they had a lot of ties with Islamist groups, and the Tamil Tigers have on the ground in Sri Lanka, what you could best describe as like a complicated relationship with Sri Lankan Muslims. So it's just difficult to work that one out.
I would say the only thing that was obviously ideological about what they said or did was that they believed that there should be a secular Tamil Elam. They were very against organized religion, but that's the only thing I could spot, obviously, as being kind of lefty.
Yeah, they're very pro-women. So, they were a largely Hindu group of people, and Hinduism is has got classism and misogyny sort of entrenched within the religion. And they have, you know, very outwardly said they don't want that. And they also, both the Indian Army and the Sri Lankan Army very happily engage in a lot of war rape and mass sexual assault of Tamil women. Whereas the Tamil Tigers very ardently against it. And if one of their fighters or someone involved with them was accused of sexual assault, they would just execute them. So there are those kind of more more progressive bits of them ideologically.
And I guess talking about women's roles in the Tamil Tiger Army kind of leads us to the next question. Mostly, what did it look like at its height? Because it was effectively, at its height, a conventional fighting force. I think it's the only militant group of its type that had aircraft. Now, most of them were, you know, nothing to write home about. They're actually like powered cycles that could fly effectively. I think they had like maybe one helicopter or something. They had the Sea Tigers, which was their navy. Again, nothing too impressive, but some impressive wins over their enemies. They had an artillery brigade. They had a mortar brigade. They had two motorcades. They had two all-female brigades, one in the north, one in the east. They had the conventional ground force, they had push bikes, they had motorbike, you know, so everything that you'd expect from an actual army was there, which is partly why the Civil War went on for so long. They really, I think a lot of military historians really point out to just how effective of a force that they were, even if potentially, you know, overall they would eventually lose for various reasons, but it could have been touch and go a couple of times. So Alex, what do you think about them as a as the sort of conventional ground force that we won't really be seeing outside of them in this season?
I mean, the fact that they were able to control a roughly about a third of Sri Lanka for over 20 years says really everything. Now, it either says everything or it says how really shit or terrified the Senlis army actually was of the Tigers. And that should play a role as well. They were able to scare the living shit out of the army. And that and it would be only when really the army had 25 years of experience could it deal with them, which we'll get to, I suppose. But it also should be said, not only are they fighting against the Senlis, but then for 2 years, I think it's between 87 and 89, they fight the fucking 100,000 Indian troops, so much so that, you know, that India goes, okay, time to go. So, I mean, they are a kind of a force to kind of, if I was to compare it in pure military terms, it reminds me a bit of groups like the Zapatistas, group like, more so like ISIS, and I mean ISIS purely in a kind of military way. There's only about 30,000 people at a given time in ISIS, and yet they controlled an enormous amount of territory. Again, other things are happening at the same time, but from a military perspective, they were obviously successful. I think the problem was that something we've already talked about, which is that you can have, and revolutionary groups can have those types of success. It's what you do with it in the time that you have. And so my problem would be with them would be many things, obviously, we've talked about, but ultimately they were not able to take advantage of the period where they were at their strength, when they were at the peak of their strength in the 90s, to actually make a deal that would have got them somewhat of what they wanted. And so you were saying earlier that, you know, after 9/11, there was a drive to have a peace process. I would say their inability to see that the odds were against them. I mean, again, 5,000 to 10,000 of them at any given time. The Senlis army is training, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. By the time they crush them, there's over 200,000 via, you know, in the Sri Lankan army. They just long term, they needed to make a deal. They needed to negotiate to get something. You know, it wasn't like a situation like the Zapatistas, where the Mexican government, after, you know, a certain amount of time of fighting with them, kind of said, oh, you just do your own thing, we'll ignore you, which is kind of, from what I know, effectively what the Mexican government has done. Or, you know, ISIS was crushed, obviously, as we know, but the Tigers didn't, their problem wasn't that they didn't have success, their problem was they weren't able to capitalize it. And in that regard, I think it says a lot about the type of leadership of the organization. And I would say, if you were to ask the average Sri Lankan person, whether Tamil or Senegalese, they would have said, no, we want peace in the late 90s, early 2000s. And the fact that that wasn't achieved, at least in some fashion, is the Tigers' fault. Obviously, it's also the government's fault, too. But I think that says more about who they were, really. If everyone's calling out for peace and you're like, nope, I'm only going to kind of half-heartedly or, you know, somewhat engage in the peace process when my worry is that the Americans are going to cut off my money from the Tamil diaspora. And even then, I'm not going to really try and get something out of it. You know, I think that says a lot about them, sadly.
Yeah, I think that the ceasefire happening in the same year as they're prescribed by the UK government. And I know the EU did prescribe them, but I actually don't know at what point they did. But that has a lot to do with it, doesn't it?
2006, when the ceasefire broke down.
Right. So that's what they got for that year. They were going to have peace talks in Oslo, and that fell apart in 2006.
So the Tamils did claim that they weren't allowed, they weren't given safe passage to Oslo. I don't know how true that is, but that was their why they said that they didn't turn up. And then their Norwegians apparently said that it was entirely their own fault. But that was just something I read in passing. I don't know the full story behind that.
if you're in, it's in 2002, 2003, 2004, we're talking about a couple of years before then. I think they say, okay, we're going to drop our demands for a completely separate state because it seemed unlikely that that was going to happen. They were proposing a federal, other people, and they were proposing a federal solution. It got bogged down. Again, I'm not suggesting it's only their fault, but the IRA in the late 90s made, and in the early 90s for that matter, made the decision to talk. And they knew they had to give up the idea of a United Ireland to do that. They did it with the idea being that, okay, we're not going to win this. And unfortunately with the Tigers, they didn't take advantage of that thing. Again, it's the don't let the great be the enemy of good. I think their inability to see that, okay, well, 40,000 less people will die, which is what people believe, somewhere between 40 and 70,000 people died between 2006 and 2009. Did those people need to die? I don't think so. And I think that it says a lot about how unrepresentative of the Tamil people they'd become by the end, that they don't try and find some way to make it make the peace stick. And again, the Sri Lanka government has their blame too. I'm not trying to say that they don't have blame. They have huge blame, from the very beginning, from the 50s and 60s onwards, they have a huge share of the blame. But, you can't pretend that they didn't have a choice in the early 2000s to try and do something different.
So, yeah, that kind of takes us to the end game for the Tamil Tigers, which is really the way that the war on terror really picks up, is invented effectively after the destruction of the Twin Towers. And the Sri Lankan government pretty much see what the West is doing and the way that they talk about groups and, the way that they discuss them to delegitimize them. Some rightly so, others a bit more complicated. And you see the Sri Lankan government just ape that language very, very quickly. And it turns out to be very effective because it also means, in the UK, for example, as Nikita was saying, this prescribed acts group means that they are effectively, they're a declared terrorist organization by the British government, which means that gives them certain ability to stop assets going into them, which is obviously where their funding problem really starts to kick in, because they were, at this point, almost exclusively funded by the Tamil diaspora sending money over. And effectively, you can, have governments come into a shop and shut it down for having the Tamil Tiger flag out front or, in there. So it creates lots of problems for the group. And it is ultimately a campaign of propaganda that I would say is pretty much what swings it to the end. So what do you guys think about that?
So I guess I don't know, really. The defining moment, what ends the war is the death of the leader. And that's, the really defining moment. But I just...
Oh, you have to pronounce his name. Go and do it.
Oh, my God. I am, the whitest Asian person ever. Prabhakaran? I'm definitely saying that wrong.
Better than Alden.
Yeah, I mean, it is phonetic, I think. So it's Prabhakaran.
Yeah, let's go for that. But yeah, so I'm just looking at this timeline that I've made. So there's, the unilateral ceasefire is in 2001. And then in 2002, the Tigers dropped the demand for a separate state. And then I've got 2005, the disappearances start again. And 2006, it all just fucking kicks off again. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you'd time it like that.
Well, Alex, you can try and... bring it round, or you can just basically say that my theory is bollocks and it doesn't work. Which one will you decide?
I mean, I think it plays a part. I mean, I think Chomsky said back in the day, and back in right after 9/11, that every reactionary government in the world is gonna be so happy about what happened on 9/11 because it'll give them the excuse to destroy any internal dissent they like, whether it be the Russians going after the Chechens, whether it be the Chinese going after name a group of people, really, or whether or whether it be, you know, the British going after its, you know, increasingly monitoring its own Muslim population, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, every country in the world took advantage of that. So, yeah, of course, it's part of it. I think other things are going on there as well. I think there was, in 2005, there was a new government that came into power. I can't remember the name of the prime minister at the time, but they were extreme Sinhalese kind of nationalists. And their view was there should be no deal done whatsoever. And I think in the end, that's, you know, the opportunity was missed, you know, and in 2005, there was really no going back. That both sides, but in particular, the Sri Lankan government didn't want a compromise, didn't want a peace. They thought, and they were proven to be right, that they had the type of resources, the money, the backing of America that was going to cut off the tiger's money and resources. And indeed, the support of the, I think, but then even the Indian government were willing to kind of cut off aid coming in from a Tamil part of India. And so they were able to do what they wanted to do, which was amass an enormous force and just hit them on every single front. And a group of 5 to 10,000 cannot deal with that type of mass assault. So, I mean, in the end, yeah, I don't know what would have happened if, you know, it makes no sense to think about what would have happened if there wasn't a war on terror. Obviously, things would have been different. But I think in the end, they, as long as there was a kind of a nationalist, ethno-nationalist kind of party in power in, I think it's Colombo is the name of the capital? Mm-hmm. Isn't it? Is Colombo's name the capital of Sri Lanka, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of also a detective, but that's a different story. But yeah, as long as they were in power there and they made up 75% of the population, and even if it was a war-weary population, as long as those in the elite were in power and they wanted to do this, I don't know if there's much that could have been done. You know, again, with all those factors in play, again, the Tigers didn't really have much chance. And you don't have to approve of everything they did to say that the people in the end who fought literally into mangrove swamps and into forests until they were hunted down and one by one killed, and they were all killed. Even the guru himself, the leader, was, his body was taken out of a swamp and displayed before the press. So I mean, I don't know if there's much, given those circumstances, that could have stopped them. And America's, what happened in America obviously plays a role, but I just don't see, given, I think sooner or later it was going to happen unless they made a negotiated settlement. The odds were against them. There's just, they were outnumbered too much, and they needed to have taken advantage of the window they had, which I already said. They didn't, and that says something about them. Also says something about the Sri Lankan government, that they didn't mind locking up tens of thousands of people in effectively concentration camps, re-education camps. To this very day, the Sri Lankan army is en masse in the Tamil parts of Sri Lanka. It's not stopped. The fact even that Deutsche Welle, the German TV station, went over there and were being brought around the parts of still heavily militarized parts of Sri Lanka that are Tamil, and that the few hotels that have opened up in those areas have to be run by the military and heavily guarded, says everything you need to know, which is that I don't think this is over. I just think that the LTTE part of it, this iteration, has stopped for the moment. But I don't think the things that caused the problems have gone away. And much like, you know, the Al-Qaeda group in Iraq from 2003 or 4 kind of was mostly locked up or killed up until 2007, 2008, but reemerges in Syria in what, 2011, 2012. There's no way this is over. I could only hope that whatever groups, you know, emerges out of the Tamil population is more representative and wiser, I suppose. But they could certainly still learn a lot from how militarily successful the Tigers were, but not obviously had their use of child soldiers or other things as well.
Have you got any closing thoughts, Nikia?
I guess while I was listening to you talk, I was just thinking of a lot of these things that acted as catalysts. So the Citizenship Act that froze out, that made South Indian migrant workers stateless, finally got rectified in 2003. The Language Act of 56 got amended in 1987. the policy of standardization in 1971, which was also a big thing that sort of negatively impacted Tamil's opportunity of education, that got abandoned in 1971. So like a lot of these official acts have over the years sort of disappeared, but I don't know if that kind of like underlying want or even need for their own land will ever go. Like, I don't know if the sentiment will disappear.
James, you say you monitor, not monitor, but well, you maybe do monitor the stuff coming out of Sri Lanka. Would you say that a lot of young people are of the view that it's over, or that it's just, it'll, or do you think it'll start again at some point in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of difficult to get a real handle on it effectively, because I don't speak the language, and so I have to do everything agnostically, basically. And also the sort of stuff that I see is sort of very selected. I wouldn't be seeing it otherwise. So there's definitely, you know, still people there that really glorify the Tamil Tigers. You know, the Tamils still used what is effectively the Tamil Tiger flag. They use that to identify themselves with. It's slightly different, but it's effectively the same flag. There is a politician called Seaman who is trying to reinnovate the Tamil Tiger sort of imagery in his campaign videos, and you know, he'll have the Tamil Tiger flag next to him, and then, you know, possibly a Prahamabrakan as this you know, like a banner that he'll be in front of. And so it definitely tells you that there's still some taste for it, in the same way that there's still, you know, some taste for the IRA in Ireland now. Now, you know, part of it, at least here anyway, is there's a veil of irony with a lot of it. But I think what my kind of point was when it came to the, you know, talking about the war on terror and how it affected it, is it presents the future as well, because you've effectively delegitimized the Tamil Tigers in the eyes of the international community by doing that. And so the Tamil, you know, people have a right to self-determination, and anything that they do from now on will always be painted with you know, the terrorist brush. So it is difficult to see how they can go forward, because they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. So we're getting close to our end point here. Anyone got any closing thoughts, anything they just want to bring up before we close out the episode?
I suppose anyone, because like the overarching theme of this season is an attempt by us to not just talk about militant groups or what people, you know, rebel groups or terrorist groups, whatever people want to call them, but try and learn something from it. I suppose if anyone that is listening to this needs to learn anything from the Tamils, is that you can, in certain circumstances, when you have a base, again, I'm assuming that the Tigers had a wide enough base in the Tamil population, you grab a, you know, an area of geographic area, but usually has to be based around some type of common identity. Now, we know when it comes to the Zapatistas, who we're going to cover, that was a class and ideological base as much as a kind of indigenous people's identity in the Chapas. But in regards the Tamils, you know, there's some similarities there. The problems with them are many, and we've just talked about them. We don't need to repeat them. But it should be said that the ability for the groups like the Zapatistas or the Kurds or other groups to survive, ultimately, when they're a minority, and they're always a minority, is you have to roll with the punches and learn to bend your principles, even if those principles are very dearly held. And that kind of goes against almost the very nature of revolutionary groups to compromise. And so I don't know. I think if you're listening to this and going, well, how would you go about doing something, you know, less horrific? But you know, you can learn something from the Tigers, but you can also learn about what not to do. And there's a lot of things you shouldn't do and you should never do that the Tigers did.
Yeah, again, it is very interesting. I know we've only done 3 episodes so far, but, you know, we've got, 7 more to go? And it's just crazy how different each group is, though. So it really shows you the adaptability to the situation is kind of important. And where they all tend to go wrong is exactly in the same place, which is not knowing when to succeed ground in terms of, like, ideological underpinnings or, you know, bad press management sometimes, but also, you know, the sort of unethical warfare really ends up working against them in a population, even though usually who they're fighting is doing it all the time as well. There's nothing unique to, you know, say, like, bombing a school. America does it all the time, but they're, you know, have the, you know, the media on their side, so they can get away with it. I guess as a, if you're a revolutionary, you have to, you effectively have to play fair, even though you know the other side is going to play dirty. But it, I guess it's again about holding some sort of moral high ground that, you know, gives you some legitimacy, because as soon as you lose that, you tend to lose the war completely. So that was our episode on the Tamil Tigers. Thanks for joining us. Nikita, do you want to plug your podcast?
Oh, yeah. So yeah, we're a leftover. We're a British left podcast, and we do focus quite a lot on South Asia. We've not done anything on Sri Lanka so far, but with regards to, like, Hindu nationalism of a different flavour, we have talked about India a bit. So yeah, we're on Twitter at Leftover Pod.
There's a very good question for a hypothetical. What would have happened if the Tamils were either more Hindu what happens if Modi would have been in charge in India when all of this, when the last days of
God.
There's a big what if.
I think they're probably too socialist for Modi to have a real interest in. But also on a case of them being less secular.
You never know with him. He might just have said, well, they're kind of, Hindu.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that is a question.
Yeah, it's not really a question to be asking at the end of a podcast, Alex. It's like...
Yeah, I'm just trying in there to ruin it, you know.
As he's a master at, like, the quick lead out. So with that great hypothetical question posed, we'll just leave it for the listener to imagine the scenario in their head. And all that's left to say is good evening. Enjoy the rest of your week. Bye, guys.
Oh, wait. Before we disappear completely, James, you have to say what we're talking about next week.
Oh, we don't know which episode we're doing next week because we'll just need to
insert a group here.
It depends who's available in our next recording stints, and so and which order they're going to be in is just going to be completely random. So we don't know is the quick answer to that.
Bye.